John Wood, reel 3.
You were just describing to me the layout of the tanks in a tanker Hercules. Now, you pointed out at one point that during flight you would top up your own system, including pumping fuel from the tanks that were in the hold, so to speak, up to your wing tanks.
That's right.
Now, I was talking to an engineer last week who told me that the last tank that they emptied on the aircraft were the internal wing tanks because of the dihedral of the wing made it difficult to pump fuel back into them.
That's right.
But this is in fact what you do.
Yes.
How do you do it when he can't? If you've got a more powerful pump in the tanker?
Well, he is basically, you can never refill the tanks completely. On the ground, you can fill the tanks to maximum capacity because the wings droop. In the air, the wings take the dihedral, so you can never take on an absolute full load. But they will fill, both from inside and, of course, refueling air to air. Luckily, the maximum capacity of the tanks is actually more than we're actually allowed to carry for structural reasons. So it is possible to take fuel up to the maximum permitted.
Maximum load
That's
as
right.
opposed to volume.
That's right.
Yeah.
The problem for the engineers is getting the fuel in balance when it comes into the tanks. It's very much a problem for the tankers because the feed up from the back is actually quite slow. And that was one of the major problems in the South Atlantic. We had to make sure that we had A, serviceable pumps, also that our wings, by our wings I mean the externals and all our normal flying tanks, we had to make sure that they were good and full so that when we'd given the fuel away, we had enough fuel ourselves to go somewhere, assuming the rear tanks failed and we could no longer couldn't get any more fuel out of them. Luckily, that's been a very, very rare occurrence. But also the fuel transfer that we gave, if it was such that the Hercules was going to need, for example, 40,000 pounds of fuel, we would inevitably give them that sort of load in two stages. We would normally try and limit the one fuel transfer to about 25,000 to 30,000 pounds. Two reasons. First one, obviously, for our own safety, that we had the fuel to get to a landing base, whether it was a diversion to Uruguay or back to Ascension Island. And the other reason, of course, was that even air to air, the transfer of fuel is quite slow. So the receiving pilot would be in close formation, in contact, possibly through cloud, for 20, 25, sometimes almost 30 minutes. The concentration level was intense. No matter how experienced, how good the pilot, that sort of concentration was very, very heavy. So it was not really fair to expect him to stay in contact much longer than that.
And the extra fuel that the tanker carries in these Andover bags, presumably that is positioned near the center of gravity of the aircraft, so you don't have massive trim changes when you're.
That's right. It's basically a freight load, and the loadmaster on the tanker, his role is to make sure that he's feeding from tanks symmetrically to keep the center of gravity correct. And he has various charts to help him, sight gauges on the tanks. And between the engineer and the loadmaster, they control the flow out of the rear tanks to keep the center of gravity as near the centre as possible.
What sort of operations are you doing now as a tanker or as a refueler?
Well, we're still operating in the South Atlantic in support of the fighters in the Falklands, and it is very much our main role. We do training tanking in the North Sea or in the Bristol Channel for our own fighters. We also obviously train ourselves, and we also refuel Nimrods. Nimrod likes the Hercules as a tanker. Although we're slightly slow for the ideal flying speed for Nimrod, we're a very stable platform for them, and it is very easy for them to make contact in relative terms and also to stay in contact compared with the big jets. We also don't create problems on their tailplanes, because obviously if you've got two large aircraft sitting one behind the other in close proximity, the tailplane of the rear aircraft gets some considerable buffeting. That obviously increases the larger and more powerful the aircraft in front. The Victor used to create tremendous buffeting for us and the Nimrods. The VC-10, not quite so much. The TriStar, we're not allowed to go behind, mainly because of its third engine, which would be blasting straight onto our tailplane. So we would not be happy sitting behind a TriStar.
The TriStar has got any wing feed points, does it?
It has, but only for fighters. Yeah. As all big aircraft have to centre feed, because we've only got one feed, which is in the centre of the aircraft. The VC-10 always centre pods us. So the Nimrod likes to be behind us. So if a Nimrod has to pre-position or do long-range flying, we can operationally support the Nimrod, and do. We still do trails for whatever reason. Certainly the changeover of the fighters to and from the South Atlantic.
What do you call trails?
A trail is when a fighter is taken from A to B, or several fighters are taken from A to B with air-to-air refuel and support, normally done by the TriStars or the VC-10s, because they've got a far larger fuel capacity than us. They fly faster, they fly higher. It's much more comfortable for the fighters. And when the changeover happens in the South Atlantic, when the aircraft down there are brought back for major servicing, they are trailed up the Atlantic with the TriStar or VC-10. But because it's a lot of ocean between the Falklands and Ascension Island, and Ascension Island and UK, they have to have search and rescue cover, which is inevitably a Nimrod. So the Nimrod has got to stay airborne for a long time as well. So whilst the fighters are trailing with their jet tanker, we support the Nimrod, and we would pre-position either in Ascension Island, in the Azores, Dakar, wherever it was considered the ideal situation, and we would then go out with the Nimrod or out to the Nimrod and rendezvous and give him extra fuel so that he can give search and rescue cover to the fighters.
Presumably also, if you're fueling Nimrods, you would go out over the North Atlantic or up towards Iceland and so on as well, would you?
Wherever we're needed.
Yeah.
You know, military aircraft, wherever our lords and masters say there's a requirement for us to go as tankers, we go.
You were saying just now that a Hercules couldn't take a feed, say, from a wing supply from the VC-10, for example. Is that because the VC-10's engine would send a wash over the starboard wing of the Herc? Or?
No, not really. It's basically the wings, obviously, on every aircraft are a long way forward of the tail. Our probe is 6 feet in front of our nose, and we've also got a big wing. So if you think of the pure mass of a wing prod, when we were in contact, our wing would be very, very close to the tailplane of the tanker, if not in contact. Not a desirable situation. So we always, because of the large aircraft syndrome, we always take centripod fueling, which puts us about 50 feet behind the other aircraft. Which I can assure you is pretty quite close.
Yeah. Were you involved in tanking in the Gulf War?
Not tanking as such. Yeah. I was certainly involved in freighting down there, and I did two detachments down there. One before the fighting started, and one after it. In fact, I took John Wakeham, the energy minister, into Kuwait to talk to the Emir about the oil fires.
What were your memories of those, the smoke clouds you had to go through and so on?
Very dramatic. The first time I went in, we actually came around the north of Saudi, and the prevailing wind was bringing the smoke to us. And when we went into the smoke, it was a complete and utter grey out. There was no, literally, even worse than being in cloud. It was much thicker. The smell in the aircraft was horrible. When we landed in Kuwait, the aircraft was covered in oil streaks. Not very a pleasant situation. On the general approaches into Kuwait, when we were moving in from Riyadh or Bahrain, coming up the coast, more often than not, we missed the smoke, but obviously we could see the fires, and the fires were very dramatic. I think history is going to say that they could have been and should have been put out a long time before they were. Tremendous pollution. The effects on the people who were stationed at Kuwait or went into Kuwait regularly will probably come up much later, but people were certainly breathing in small globules of oil because the oil pollution in the air was very, very minute, and one didn't even notice it was around until sometime later. One looked at flying suit or coverall, whatever one was wearing, and it was smothered in little tiny oil stains. So not a very pleasant situation. And certainly, obviously, not pleasant at all for the Kuwaitis.
When you were freighting in during the war, presumably you had quite a complicated route to fly in. I mean, would you go down the Red Sea and turn left? Or?
Yes, we went down the Red Sea, and we went down a long ways, to basically down to southern Saudi, all the way around Mecca. And we approached Riyadh, which is our main staging post. We approached Riyadh from the south, and with some exceptions, obviously, the main run was that we took freight into Riyadh, and the resident crews at Riyadh distributed it around the various bases in Saudi and Bahrain. The exception, perhaps, was that from Akrotiri we would tend to go to Tobruk direct, which is the base in western Saudi, well out of the way of everyone else, but still an important base. We did occasionally go into Jubail direct, which is to the north of Riyadh, mainly because that was probably the most important forward base at the time, and they wanted their supplies in there very directly.
So you didn't go into any of the satellite bases, the strips?
We didn't, no, or certainly I didn't. Mine was all airfield deliveries. The strip-type approaches were again done by SF and one or two of the other crews off 47 and 70. One or two of our own, of the 30 and 24 squadron crews, did do some strip stuff, but not very much.
And can you describe to me a bit the scene at Riyadh at the time, the amount of traffic and so on?
Well, we took over what I think was quite a small, well, it was a large airport, but quite a sleepy airport. And we took over one small area of it, and that became quite intense with ourselves and the French and some Americans as residents. And then...
Freighters, were they?
All freighters, yeah, Transalls and Hercules. And then there were regularly deliveries coming in with TriStars, VC-10s, and other Transals, other Hercules. So the movement at our small part of Riyadh was quite high. Nothing, of course, compared to the movement at Jebel or Tobruk or even Bahrain, where the basis from which the fighters were flying. Riyadh really was mainly transport and logistics. And we were working quite hard when we were there. But from the airport point of view, much, much easier than certainly than Jebel. Jebel was frantic, to say the least.
That was a purpose-built base, was it?
Jebel was a Saudi fighter base almost on the east coast of Saudi, which we effectively took over. And it was a major logistics base for the troops in the desert just south of Kuwait. So freight was coming in from America, from Britain, from all over the world in quite large quantities. The biggest problem was refueling and ground handling. And it was under the control of the Americans working with the Saudis. And that was not an ideal combination.
Of course, a lot of the fuel out there was from Saudi oil anyway, but
that's
presumably
right.
Their refinery capacity was insufficient to meet all of it, was it?
Well, it wasn't so much the capacity to meet the fuel requirements as the capacity to get it into the aircraft. Very small refueling bays. The Americans were using slipper tanks, which basically didn't have the capacity to refuel the very large aircraft they were getting. DC-10s, Galaxies, 747s, TriStars were all going in there, all needing fuel. They didn't have the space to really to stack the aircraft properly on the ground. They didn't seem to coordinate the timing of aircraft terribly well. Albeit it was very, very busy anyway, but there were still great log jams of aircraft. And they just basically got overloaded, much to the upset of the crews who were flying incredibly long hours anyway and were faced with further delays, sometimes unnecessarily, because the ground handlers just either didn't get messages or didn't listen to the messages. But Jebel in particular, which was not the most successful from the point of view of an air transport organization. The rest of the handling in Jebel and how it was perceived by the people on the ground, I don't know. I would imagine they considered it to be quite successful because we certainly poured stuff in there. The difference between Jebel and Tobruk, which was also handled by the Americans but with a different attitude, was considerable. Tobruk was a lot smaller than Jebel, and they had even greater problems because they had greater problems from the locals. But it was handled somehow far better. And we really had no problems in Tobruk.
Did you experience any Scud attacks while you were in Riyadh?
No, I left Riyadh just before the war started, having done my stint down there. I came back. And in fact, I went off to Belize just after Christmas of that year. And then...
You were freighting there, were you?
I was freighting down to Belize. And then when I came back and I started doing the runs down to the Gulf again, I was never involved in any of the Scuds. And in fact, most of them had happened in the period when I was out of theatre. And then when I moved back down to Riyadh to do my second detachment, basically the fighting was over and it was the clearing up stage.
What other work have you been doing since the Gulf War and so on? Have you been on Operation Bushel?
No, I missed Bushel because at that stage I was having a short ground tour at Bryce Norton in Tanker Task Plans. So I missed out on the Bushel operation, which was a pity. I would have enjoyed that. That really is doing a worthwhile job. The people who went down there enjoyed it, but unfortunately.
I've spoken to a number of them. So there was a time then when you came off tankers, went on to freighting during the Gulf War, and then went back onto tankers.
Well, no, it was basically the Gulf War. We never actually had a tanking capacity down there. We had no requirement for tankers. The tankers were never used. They were basically kept in reserve, I assume, or just left in UK for training. And also, of course, bear in mind that even with the Gulf War, we still had the Mount Pleasant situation, so which is our prime reason to be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we still had two tankers in the South Atlantic, irrespective of what was going on elsewhere. So we didn't have the capacity to be really involved in the Gulf. And the Herc fleet was basically freighter only in the Gulf War.
Do you work with the AWACS squadron from time to time? Refuel?
We haven't done so as yet. I don't see any reason why we shouldn't, and we probably will in the future. Because again, the big aircraft, especially with their radar dome on the top, wouldn't be terribly comfortable behind the jet refuelers. They would be quite comfortable behind us. That's assuming, of course, they actually have the need for air-to-air refueling.
Are they designed to refuel from a flexible hose, or because the Americans have a fixed delivery point?
Yes, I honestly don't know anything about the AWACS refueling.
Yeah.
You know, even if they've got the requirement.
You haven't worked to an extender or anything.
No.
A KC-10.
No.
I was just thinking back, of course, when you were talking about the Nimrods being so compatible. Your prop wash is good and high anyway because you've got a high wing. And of course, they've got low tail planes. I presume if they were T-tails, there would be a bit more of a problem.
Not really.
No,
basically, the prop wash is well out. And by time it gets back to them, it's more or less flattened itself out. And in fact, just helps them with their rudder control. And it hasn't got the turbulence. The Hercules, albeit quite a large aircraft, just doesn't have the turbulence behind it that the jets do. And that, I think, is the big problem, is turbulence behind the other aircraft, which throws the tailplanes around. We don't seem to... Obviously, there's turbulence there, and their tailplanes must move, but it's to such a lesser degree than the jets that they're prepared to accept it.
When you were temporarily out of the RAF, you know, just before the Falklands came up, I mean, had you settled into a civilian job then?
Yes, I had. I was a building site manager, and relatively happy. But the Air Force had made a little bit of a Horlicks on its redundancy in the 70s, and with the volunteers, they committed themselves to accept voluntary redundancies as well. They'd actually ended up in early 79. Short of pilots. And
so you got your redundancy anyway.
I actually left at the 38 retirement point.
Oh, I see.
And the Air Force wouldn't keep me on at 38. 1 year later, they were so short of pilots that I was trawled back.
And they're still keeping you on now?
They're still keeping me on now.
So, I mean, when have you to retire now? 55 or what?
55. I've got just over 2 years to go.
Well, they've got a good experienced pilot here. There's no point in losing you.
Well, I was lucky, I think, that I was actually on a squadron when the redundancies came out. Because I don't know whether it was policy, but it does seem as though most of the redundancies were made in out-of-squadron posts. And because I was on a squadron, I struck lucky. I must admit, I was a little concerned for a short while. I had no desire to go out.
So what, 55 is back to the building site, is it? Or?
Well, certainly back to something. There is always the chance that they'll get the numbers wrong again, and we should be short of pilots, so I might get a 3-year extension. But that's highly unlikely.
Is there anything else you feel you ought to tell me? I've run out of questions. You've been going for an hour and a half now, then. Is it? I mean, looking back on your time, it's obviously been a very satisfying career for you.
No, satisfying career, I think, is the wrong word. It's been a very interesting lifestyle. As a career, it's not particularly good. The competition is obviously very high because of the people we recruit. There would certainly be more career satisfaction in the outside world, because one would assume that most of the people who come into the Air Force could and should do quite well. But it is certainly a very interesting life and quite a fun life. And I think that's why so many of us are quite happy to sacrifice career, as the modern day concept of career is involved, with promotion, success, for the lifestyle that we've got.
Have you got a family?
Yes, indeed.
And any of your children? Any, you've got sons that might be following you up?
Or? No. My son is a trainee solicitor, and my daughter is a credit controller, and neither will be coming into the Royal Air Force.
And your wife, has she sort of followed you around? I suppose she's lived here for some time.
She has done. We moved around with the Air Force, 3 years in Malta, 4 years in Germany, and the Malta postings in between. My daughter had 7 addresses before before her 5th birthday. But when I left the Air Force, I settled back into the Forest of Dean, and I now commute. The family stay in the Forest of Dean. So
you just stay in the mess here when you...
No, I commute.
Every day?
As and when required, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Sign of the change of times, that people actually commute to the services as opposed to living on basis.
Well, John Wood, thank you very much for talking.
You're welcome.
All this time. You've given me a lot of valuable experience and list of impressions, and I'm sure it'll be a worthy addition to the archive. Thanks very much.
Great.